Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 128, In Praise of Tsongkhapa.
You know, the guy who... You know, Eckhart Tolle, who saved his own life from suicide out of depression, he did that because the reason he was going to kill himself, if you know his work, that guy, is that the voice that was telling him he was no good and life was not worth it and the universe was horrible and blah, 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 he might as well kill himself, it seemed like an absolute mandate to him. And the way he saved himself was somewhere he somehow intuitively, instinctively sensed at a deep level where he was close to killing himself, the way he tells it, at a deep level that that voice was not absolute, that he didn't have to listen to it. So another voice, a critical voice, rose in him saying, why are you listening to this? This is not your absolute voice speaking from your absolute self. It's just a bad habit, bad trend. And you don't have to listen to it. So that's the discovery of relativity. Although he didn't put it in those terms because he doesn't know this. He didn't learn this. He thinks it's just he got into now. Now told him. I know the guy, we're friends. Or I explained this to him over pasta. In an Italian restaurant, best place to have. And in between slurping pesto, spaghetti, he agreed. He claimed he's writing a book to say that there's different kinds of the now. If the now is captured within some kind of notion of materialism and nihilism, it becomes an escapist, psychotic now, although it's a bit of a relief to people, but then they get stuck in it. If the now is the infinite, if the now contains all causality from the infinite past of your evolution and the fact that you and all beings are each other's mothers, and then the infinite future of your Buddhahood, it's like much cooler now. Instead of a dead Mao, a dead American Mao, dead mouse Mao. Mao is a dumb Mao.
But there's some people who
want to
ask a question.
Sure. Yeah. Not just to me.
Please use mic.
He won't be able
to hear you otherwise.
Okay. My question...
Well, Lorraine always has a question.
I know. I'm so sorry. I can't tell myself I'm not going to ask anymore, but I can't.
You're not sorry. You're... sukha, chitta. I'm sorry. Okay, what's your question?
Well, my question then, meaning after everything you've just said, is about enlightenment and the moment or the impossibility of there being a moment of enlightenment.
Yeah, sure. Of course there's a moment of enlightenment.
But...
Actually, since this is Tsongkhapa's holiday and we're having a puja about that in an hour, we're going to light candles... because it's a festival of candles in Tibet. It's Tibetan Hanukkah, candle festival. And you know, the Jews thought they came from Ur, but they actually came from Tibet. So actually, because they herded animals, you know, in Tibet, and they wanted, okay, never mind, that's a joke. So talk about a special thing as a, you know, about enlightenment that actually annoyed some other Tibetan lamas, actually, and even may annoy people in general. was the total non-duality of enlightenment. And what is so important about that is, you see, you can have an experience of oneness. I think I mentioned it already in a talk yesterday, which I call the cheap oneness, where you go into something like that space-like equipoise samadhi, and you think that's enlightenment, because it's a big relief to get in it. And you may be guided by a philosophical naivete, let's say, or an intellectual naivete, where you think that a relative thing can find an absolute, and there are, which is the natural one. You know, Moses, you know, this bush, this like dumb bush, just like our dumb bushes, another dumb bush, told him, go tell Pharaoh and let my people go and everything. And Moses, you know, first he tried to be logical. He said, look, who are you? Oh, you're God. Okay, well, you go tell Pharaoh. You know, he might listen to you more than me. Which is what? That's a way to talk to a burning bush that's giving you orders. I question that. And not only that, but then that bush says, no, I'm going to go tell Pharaoh not to agree with you. Oh, what? Why are you sending me? He might kill me. And so, you know, like, it's the whole story. So human beings think that's all very normal. You know, in 2001, remember that movie?
Oh, yes.
It's a big black stone, all beautifully carved and rectangular. They're all looking at it. That's the absolute. It's a big black stone. But that's a relative thing. You couldn't see it. Absolute means you can't relate to it. Absolute doesn't relate to the relative. Or it's not absolute. All the theologians, they say, God creates the world, but he's not related to it. The world is nothing, just everything is God. That's just asinine, irrational statements. They just say that because they're feeling absolute, you know, and they're up on the pulpit there. And that's their absolute ego projection, you follow me? So the royal reason of relativity, if you don't know that, that anything you can experience, because you experience it, is relative. Okay? You cannot, a relative being cannot experience the absolute. It's impossible. Or it's not absolute. Okay? But all that the absolute is, in a way, therefore, is the negation of any relative absolute. You could say. That's what emptiness is, or freedom is. You can't find freedom, but you can be free from something. But freedom itself as an absolute is just a negation. Okay? So I know you're brimming with new questions before listening to the answer, but
I'm trying so hard. I'm not listening.
I'm getting there.
Yes.
And if you have to try to follow the thinking. So Tsongkhapa's special thing was he did not go for the cheap oneness. He attained it many times. It's all one space. And everything really is that. It all dissolves into that. And I'm here knowing that. And nobody else is around to bother me. And I don't have to worry about them because they all dissolve into it anyway, too. So I've disappeared permanently from the universe and I've become absolute. And we call that, oh, I'm one with God. He disappeared too. God doesn't care about anybody but the Brahmins, you know, because they all disappear. That's cheap oneness, I call it. So cheap. Of course, it's actually ultimate psychosis. You go into a psychotic state because the mind is so powerful. You go, you know, because you are feeling that we're the real us, is that we are something that nobody else can be and is not relative to anything because it's the really real. And we run around with this psychotic center, which we've never found, but we are certain that it's there. And actually we have a strong escapist wish to withdraw into it. And we can even, if we become a materialist and we're tired of being threatened with hell by some preacher, we can then go and say, oh, but that thing, that absolute is actually nothingness, which things really are. And so I just don't have to shoot myself and then I'm released and escaped. I've escaped from everything. That's just, so who needs space like equipoise samadhi? Just shoot yourself. Those Zen guys who think that Buddhist emptiness is the same as their material, because they went, they're biologists or something, you know, before they got Zen, you know. And that the real thing is they're just going to disappear, and that's modern Buddhism. They're wasting their time being Zen. They should just shoot themselves. Right away. No. No, you have to control your mind, not thinking. So don't have a special thing.
But see, my problem is that I don't know what I have.
No, shush. Don't have a special, smile is good, but shush. Don't have a special thing was that he fully got that, and he realized that the real expensive oneness, the Buddha oneness, the jewel oneness, is you are everybody else. There, you, in a way, you take your psychosis and you embrace everybody in it. So actually, you don't escape from them. There's no escape. You're with them forever, and they're with you forever. And you see that they're fine, actually, because everything is bliss, transparency, vajra, reality, which gives you good encouragement as a doctor. You see there's health in them. They are made of health, actually. Health is bliss. Bliss is health, same. And this is the amazing thing. Dzongkhapa said in 1398, when he achieved that understanding, he said it was the opposite from what he expected. And he was 41 years old, and he was a master scholar of all of Buddhism. Incredible. He was sought after all over Tibet as a teacher and everything. Master teacher. But he said it was opposite from what he expected. But what did he mean by that? I mean, I don't really know. I didn't achieve that, but I think I have a good idea. And that is, if you attain enlightenment where you are the whole universe, all the beings, that is, all their subjectivities, then who the hell are you? You're not a big deal. No way. In fact, you're all blissed out, so you're not even bothered to be a deal. But who's the big deal then? They're all a big deal. Why? Because they're not enjoying themselves. They're suffering. They're going to hell. They're harming each other. So enlightenment is a state of being everybody, with everybody, for everybody. Therefore, the enlightened being becomes the servant of everybody, not some higher being above them. This is why certain Tibetan lamas after Dzongkhapa get really irritated with him. Because people who have a little bit disappearing experience, and they were high lamas, they had big meditations. They go into big states of divine states and trance states and stuff, and then come back and have high concentration. They know a lot of books. They read a lot of stuff. But emotionally, they're freaked out to really be equal with everybody else. Enlightenment is you're the same as everybody else.
And you really think that they are freaked out by
it? Yeah, and the problem is they don't think so. They keep worrying. What is it? What is it? What is it? But actually, they're fine and they can relax. So you're just there to serve them and answer their questions forever. And some of them think they're going to keep questioning you forever. But that gets tiresome to you a little bit. So now and then you tell them to be quiet and think. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I know what I'm talking about.
No, you're not. I know you're not.
No, I am.
But what do you say?
I'm kidding. Are you kidding?
What do you say to
someone? I'm kidding. Are you kidding?
I don't know if I'm kidding.
So, Bob, I'd like to talk a little bit here. Can I talk?
So, but this is really key, though. Because why? The High Lama, the enlightened person, how many of these boring enlightened people do we have running around? And what do they want? 55 Rolls Royces. Maybe they want sexual services. Maybe they want to just be worshipped. What do they want? They want to be higher than you. Yes. That's the key point. But the real one is not. His Holiness Dalai Lama totally blew my mind in Switzerland last year, after 48 years, or 3 years ago. And he loves to teach this verse that the Buddha says. He says, mendicants, a wise person accepts my teaching after critical reflection, like a goldsmith buys gold after burning, cutting, and rubbing it on a touchstone. And the cutting is critical analysis. Rubbing it on a touchstone is measuring it against your experience. You know, I forgot what cutting is. I don't know, but they all fit in commentary. You know? And doesn't just accept it because the gold seller says this is gold. So they don't accept out of faith in me, he says. It's a Buddhist statement, verse from Sutra. So His Holiness was explaining that to 10,000 people in Switzerland in a big auditorium. And then he leaned forward. He was sitting on that kind of throne like Dalai Lama sits on. And he leaned forward like that. And he just assumed the posture of a very humble waiter in a Chinese restaurant, like, do you want, you know, like noodles or like whatever? And he was saying he could just see Shakyamuni Buddha. He said, I can see poor Shakyamuni Buddha. He says, telling his students, don't just accept what I say because I have this weird looking thing with big ears and a dome on top of my head and lights coming out of my ears. But accept it if it fits in your reason and it fits with your experience, then you use it and find it useful, then you accept it. And he said, he's begging them to think it through and take it into themselves and like find the challenge in their own mind to this, to what he teaches them. Not just say, oh, Buddha said so, so now I believe in selflessness. That's useless. And I was looking, there were a bunch of lamas, and there were a bunch of other kinds of priests, because you know, he always likes, you know, multi-religious students. As I was on one side of the stage, because I wasn't really properly attending, I was just kibitzing as I was there on some job, you know. And they were looking kind of nervous. And they get, because the paradox, the guy who's the top authority, you know, the Dalai Lama, supposedly, and he is a great scholar in Tibetan and so on, and everyone acknowledges it, and a great practitioner. He always says he isn't, but he is. But, and here he's saying, like, I'm your servant. I'm not some high thing that you're supposed to, like, put on a pedestal, although people do. But the actual real one is not like that. The real one is at whatever level the people are, meeting them where they need to be met. And this was Dzongkhapa's great, I'm praising Dzongkhapa. I'm sorry, I'm not fully mind. We can do more on this. But I'm praising Dzongkhapa. And he realized that. So he, for example, he could have right at that moment resigned as a monk, as a mendicant, and he could have gone into some yogas, like unexcelled yogas, you know, this yabhyum business, you know, high chakra things, and really far out things that they do. Could have done that. But if he'd done that, his whole attempt to create the monastic university thing as a really solid center of Tibetan culture instead of the army, you know, this thing of creating this education system as the heart of the country, as the main budgetary item of the country, it would have been defeated because a lot of younger fake people who think they're enlightened would rush off and grab some and fool around. So he just worked for his people for 21 years. Denied himself some levels of the bliss of enlightenment, and he worked very hard, organized, made statues, built buildings, dealt with things, politics, you know, just like His Holiness Dalai Lama has worked unbelievably hard for 60 years rebuilding Tibetan culture in India, building monasteries. He just tore his heart out for all his people. It's just extraordinary what he's done, and for the world. And told all these leaders this and that, and been begging the Chinese, talk to me, just meet me, talk to me. And they're so imprisoned in their paranoia, they haven't been able to do it. Except Xi Jinping might, because when he was 1 year old, he was blessed by the Dalai Lama. He doesn't remember, but his father liked the Dalai Lama and brought him to be blessed as a child, 1954. Definitely. So, just a second. So that's why Dzongkhapa's service to us all, to the Tibetans, and therefore to all of us, was so huge, because he didn't just decide, oh, I'm now enlightened and I'm going to sit back and collect the donations and, you know, like everybody can worship me. He didn't do that. He totally went to work at every level that was needed to do the work. This is around the turn of the 15th century. Tibet had a hugest renaissance. And actually, nobody understands the culture of Tibet. You know, my colleagues absolutely do not. Because they can't understand it, because there was this Protestant ethic thing going on in this American, Euro-American academia. And they think it was so brilliant. Martin Luther was a genius. And Calvin, because they shut down all the monasteries in Europe. But what happens when you shut down all the monasteries? All the young men want to go fight somebody. They want to have a war. And then they want to procreate too, and your population explodes. And then what do you do with that population? Oh, you go out and genocide the Native Americans, the Africans, the Indians, the Chinese, as many people as you can, and try to conquer the world. And they did. Right? And they think, therefore, that's a really great thing. But everybody who's conquered doesn't think it was a great thing. And now they're destroying the world. Same bunch of people. They're destroying it. And they're destroying themselves because they're loonies.
So
the monastery is the great institution that conquers militarism in history, in societies. It was invented by Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. Eight centuries before the Chinese could tolerate, seven centuries before the Chinese could tolerate, and eight centuries before the Europeans could tolerate. And they know the Muslims don't have monasteries. There's nothing about celibacy in Islam. But some people should be celibate. They're happier. They don't know what to do on Saturday night, so they're going to shoot people in rock and roll instead of they have lousy lovers.
Everyone's telling me not to ask a question.
What?
Everyone's telling me not to ask a question.
Other people, there might be.
No. Yeah. Well, let me get Gabriel.
But I haven't asked my question yet. I'm sorry. I'm leaving first thing tomorrow morning.
Okay. What's your question?
And I just want to know.
Next question.
Wait, hold on.
It's good.
How am I deluding myself?
What's that?
How am I deluding myself? What trap am I falling into if I agree with everything you're saying and it all makes sense to me?
If you agree with everything I'm saying?
And I don't...
You said two things. If you agree with what I'm saying for no reason, then you're up a creek. If it makes sense, then you better stop disagreeing. If it makes sense.
It does make sense.
Oh, then what's the problem?
I'm not an enlightened being.
Well, who says? How do you know? If you're not enlightened, you don't know what you are.
That's
Isn't
true.
Isn't that true?
I don't know. I don't know what I am.
Oh.
That's right.
So that certain statement that you just made, I'm not an enlightened being, you don't even know what you are.
Well,
if you're not enlightened, you don't know. You might be.
Oh, and that's a great answer to my question. So that's a trap I'm falling into.
What?
It
I'm
is.
Sorry, what?
It's a great answer to my question.
I'm not interested in being a great answer. I'm interested in whatever makes sense to you. If it makes sense, then you should chew on that sense. That's the only reason I shut down your tendency to ask more questions before listening to answers.
One of my problems
because that
is
will help you.
I can't articulate it.
Because someone who is in the grip of not listening to their own common sense, one of the defenses is a kind of wrong kind of a doubt, where just sort of automatically doubt everything to avoid thinking with your common sense. It's a kind of doubt that is not creative. Right. Creative doubt is a doubt that seeks common sense. And when something makes sense, then it chews on that. Okay?
You.
How's that?
That is good.
Good. Okay, Gabriel. That's the angel Gabriel.
Chita Sukha Samsam.
Chita Sukha Samsam. When did the first Dalai Lama come in this story after Tsongkhapa? How can you tell that story?
When did the first Dalai Lama
came into this story after? How the first Dalai Lama came in this story after Tsongkhapa? What was the first Dalai Lama doing, you know, in this whole...
He actually was a nephew of Tsongkhapa from Amdo. He was also Amdoa. And Tsongkhapa was Amdoa. And actually Tsongkhapa almost looked like a Westerner. One of his negative nicknames was Amdo Nawache, big-nosed Amdo. He was. So he was a cousin, and he came to central Tibet, and he was one of Tsongkhapa's later disciples, because he was only born in 1392. But he was, of course, himself incarnation of Manjushri, of Avalokiteshvara, and so on. So he became another very great servant of the Tibetan people, and the Dalai Lamas have been the servants of Tibetan people. And, you know, people go around saying Tibet was a theocracy. That is false. Tibetans don't believe in an omnipotent, absolute God. They don't. They believe in gods. They're relative gods. And those gods, the gods like Buddha, who's a relative manifestation of Buddha. And they like humans to recognize that they're relative, so that humans don't accuse the gods of creating evil and suffering, which otherwise humans eventually do. And therefore, the gods are all followers of Buddha, actually, in history, according to the Buddhists, which might be fake. So the point is, that's a historical question, and the thing to celebrate about Tsongkhapa in that light is that he declined to to nominate or to name an incarnation and to create an incarnation institution. He declined to do that because he felt there would be a greater service to the Tibetan people to have to, and the, those who are in this monastic university system, to have to strive to lead the order by being the best, most kind, the best servant of the others, the best teacher of the others. He felt not, that was, in this life, that was a great thing. And the Dalai Lamas have followed in that vein since then, when allowed to, and they've been great leaders. And this particular Dalai Lama is actually the greatest leader on the planet, actually, at the moment. But, and he's met almost all the world leaders except the Chinese ones. He never met them. And maybe he never met Putin, I don't know. He met Gorbachev and Yeltsin and so forth, but he may never have met Putin. You know, because everyone who meets him somehow becomes a little less silly. Somehow. You know, and they sort of get out of Putin's thing like this and this. Someone did say that Putin was a little too vain, he once said, in the press in Europe. It's got the Mongolians and Russia in big trouble. Anyway, but we're talking about Tsongkhapa. So today is the day that Tsongkhapa did that, where he disappeared. And I personally have what I call a morphogenetic theory of history. I don't know if you know what that means. Do you know morphic resonance? Did you hear of that concept? Never heard of Rupert Sheldrake?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Rupert Sheldrake is a biologist at Oxford, which really pisses off the materialists at Oxford. But he's a biologist at Oxford who studies imitative patterns in animals. And from that type of, and even in micro animals, in laboratory settings. And he came up with a theory which he calls morphic or morphogenetic resonance, which is that patterns in the brain of living beings transmit to the brains of other living beings without language or without any kind of attempt to communicate. So it's like the 100 monkey phenomenon. 80 monkeys learn how to not get their hands stuck in a coconut by pulling out too many nuts, you know. They learn to let two go, and then the last 20 learn much quicker. It's kind of studies like that. And he calls that morphic resonance. The way when geese turn, they don't turn in a swoop, they instantly turn when the leader turns, etc. So it's instantaneous, he has photographic things about it. And so on this, and he studies that human fashion, you know, why fads and fashion, people suddenly like the look of this or that. It's like a pattern in the brain, brains of beings transmits itself, you know. And we have it in modern terms, in what we call vibes. You know, you go somewhere where there are good vibes and you're a little down, but then you feel better. Because the vibes, like you absorb the vibes. And, or you go to a place where there are bad vibes, and even you were feeling good, and you start feeling terrible. So because of the morphic resonance, this event that happened in the turn of the 15th century, it happens to be the time of Petrarch and Decameron, you know, the Renaissance. Paolo, Cello, Paolo and Cello, those guys. They all start painting, because they all start feeling that the individual being can achieve something and they don't have to be groveled down under the church. And they feel they can get something, they can do something in life. The human being has value. They become more anthropocentric worldwide, actually. And there's a similar thing happens in Japan and China, actually, in those Ming Dynasty and the Tokugawa, Muromachi and Tokugawa Shogunate.
What's your theory?
And two centuries later in Tibet, it leads to the creation of a unique form of society that never lasted anywhere else. It leads to what you could call a monastocratic society. So the absolute opposite of Calvin Switzerland and the secularization process, a sacralization process occurs. An amazing thing, actually. But never mind. That's another story. We're just celebrating Tsongkhapa. Today is day of fulfillment, 1419.
Can you tell us about that morphogenetic theory what? Of you? Can you tell about that morphogenetic theory of you?
It's what was the what?
He wants to know about the morphogenetic theory that you have.
Oh yeah, well, it's just that people, you know, when you meditate, it's very important actually for people who contemplate doing retreats actually. when you study, you know, people get into this thing of should I do a retreat, should I meditate, or should I go out and run a soup kitchen or do something, or go to Africa and start a school, etc., etc. And, you know, different ones, it's correct, either one is correct. Not that there's one rule. But very important for those who do Mahayana retreats or Bodhisattva or non-dualist retreats, that when something changes in your mind, when your egotism becomes less, when you become less self-involved, and self-obsessed, and self-preoccupied, and always me all the time, and you see through that, and you become a little released from that, and more aware of what's around you, and even coming up to the point of enlightenment where you feel that the other life, the other heartbeats around are of equal or greater importance than your own, because there are more of them. Each one is equally important, in other words. You come to that, have a visceral feeling of that, which is what enlightenment is. You're not some being off in space. Then, by morphic resonance, whatever degree of that, and all the other beings around you, and even in the whole world, can absorb, there'll be this little shift in their awareness, you know? Like the berserk, you know, shooter might just not shoot one less person, because you had such a feeling in your meditation. So the shooter might say, okay, leave that one alone, because they like the clothes they're wearing or something, or whatever. It's like a tiger, you know, like a crocodile. You know, the zebras are going across the water hole, and the crocodile, or the lioness, better example, the lioness sees the herd running, and she could gobble down and feed her kids and that really boring husband. And she could feed them all with a really juicy, pregnant wildebeest. You know, in the later trimester, whatever it is for wildebeest, the timing. But she lets that one go, and she sees some old, stringy-looking, weird old guy and chomps him up, because he's really useless anyway. And then, of course, your materialist would say, oh, she wants to eat that baby too later when it's grown up. She's going to eat two of them. That's why she does it. But actually, she's pregnant herself with cubs, with lion, whatever they're called, lion puppies. And she somehow subliminally has a sense of identification with the wildebeest, but she has to eat them. That's her instinct. So she lets that one go. Just lets it go, and pounces on a creepy old guy. And that is the seed of her Buddhahood, right there. And she got that because you were in a cave in Tibet meditating, and you got less egotistical. You were in Dusseldorf, you know, acupuncturing people, and you got a little less worrying about Gabriel. And then that lioness let that zebra go, or that like wildebeest. That's morphic resonance, that idea. Something like that. So therefore we see in the 5th century, 6th century before the Common Era, in Buddha's time, every culture in Eurasia at least, we just don't know the histories in Sub-Saharan Africa, Australia, and the Americas in those days. We don't really know what happened. They pretend that they're all horrible pyramids and nasty people, but that's their justification for genociding them. So we don't have to believe that, actually. They might have been quite interesting people. They certainly built better cities than London and Madrid and Paris, in Mexico and in Peru, at least. And in mound builders in America. Much bigger and better cities. They had a really natural wealth. And so in that 5th century, you have, you know, the pre-Socratics, and then Socrates and Plato, you have Confucius and Lao Tzu, China, you have Zoroaster in Persia. You have these amazing people everywhere at that time doing similar breakthroughs. That's morphic, I consider that morphogenetic resonance. And then 1400, we have Renaissance. And of course, the Eurocentric people think that's we just did that. Leonardo did it. Leonardo was in the time of the second Dalai Lama. He's a contemporary of second, third Dalai Lama. And then Potala building, the fifth Dalai Lama was made head of Tibet, responsible for Tibet. And then they built the Potala building, that huge and amazing palace. And he created a government where he had one monk and one mendicant and one layperson in every office. You know, Secretary of State was two people, Secretary of Treasury was two people, etc., whatever the equivalents were, to completely ingrain the university system in the government system and completely demilitarized all the regional nobles and made them, gave them back their traditional estate only, not the whole province, as a salary for serving the government in Lhasa and living in a house in Lhasa, having a Hotel de Ville in Lhasa, in the year of the birth of Louis XIV, of the Roi Soleil. And the Roi Soleil built Fontainebleau and Versailles to have a party to lure the barons away from Burgundy and Provence and here and there so they would stop, you know, having their personal armies and so he could build a nation. That's the purpose of the party. It wasn't just that he liked frou-frouing around and eating horrible food. Did you know that the food was really awful in Versailles? I know this is sacrilege pour les Français.
No, I think he's the one who reinstated the vegetables, actually.
No. They might have tried and tried, but until Escoffier in the 19th century, French food for those high people was horrible. Why? It was all sculpture. They put the goose meat in with lard, and they sculpted palaces in Greece, and then they dished out the part of the lard and had to try to digest that. They really needed Tibetan medicine, 100%. Those poor French nobles. What?
They were not drinking water.
Whatever they did, they absolutely were tortured until Escoffier, who began serving hot food. Meanwhile, the peasants, when they had food, they were serving it hot in their you know, houses and their stews and things. You know. But only Escoffier started hot food in France. I was shocked when I heard that. I couldn't believe it. And perfectly true.
Well, anyway, that's the science.
What?
I need evidence.
I know. Well, look it up. Well, that guy who was played by, you know, your famous actor who then tried to migrate to Russia to avoid Hollande's tax. You know? Oh, yeah, Gerard, he's a lovely guy. He was in a movie with Uma, and I like him. But the cook that he was, so that he was doing that sculpture stuff, you know, not hot food, not a decent burger to be found. That's why you're in Portland.
I was wondering why. Now I know.
Anyway, any other question? No, about selflessness, that's the most important thing. And then also, Dzongkhapon, he also did another innovation. He did this amazing thing. You know those giant tankas on mountains?
Yes.
You know the huge one that's like comes down a whole mountain? He started that.
Yes.
And these are tankas that are like an acre size. You know, icons of Buddha or medicine Buddha, whatever, you know, huge thing. But where did that come from? Because that came from his time. Because in his time, the Tibetans were having these mass visions all the time. They would look up and there was like, a thing like this would be in the sky and everybody, not just the psychics and the mystics, everybody would see them. And then there's a festival somewhere, and then they'd go there. And this happened in Europe too. Francis of Assisi's time, you know, people would have visions and a whole village would be, and then people would come from other villages and they'd have festivals. And of course, modern materialists, oh, that's hagiography. Oh, that can't happen because we're materialists. But you know, the ultimate killer one on that, I have to say, it's a side story, but it's sort of relevant. I have a friend called Raoul Birnbaum, who's a professor at Santa Cruz, if he's still alive. I haven't seen him in a couple of decades. But he went to Wutaishan in China, Ryu Zheng'an, in the 80s. And that's a place, it's the holy land of Manjushri. There are five mountains, and they're weird mountains that are all flat on top, all five of them. And there's springs coming up on top of these mountains, which is kind of weird. There's no really higher mountains around, but they're springs. So they're supposed to be pure land of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. Okay, and then there's a tradition there that there are mass visions there that people commonly see for centuries. The Lord's done that. And he was studying there in the 80s, and he saw some himself, but he got tired of coming back and nobody would believe him, that he'd gone native and he was part of the cult or something, mass hypnosis, whatever it was. So he gave a speech at the Academy, American Asian Studies Academy, in the spring of 87 or 85, I can't remember exactly. So I happened to be there. And at the high moment of the speech, he pulled out this road sign, which was one of those like white road signs with red Chinese characters written on it, with chains on the two ends of the sign, you know, that you put across the road to block a road, you know, like construction ahead or something like that. And the Chinese speakers in the audience all agreed, and it said, "Do not go further. Mass visions are illegal in the People's Republic of China." On a road sign. Well, it's evident. So it was a marvelous time. When you know, like when you do that meditation where you visualize like the medicine Buddha or the wonderful Yutok Yandagombo, the medicine guy, you know, when you do that, like people, the whole people would see that. So then they sort of lost that, it didn't happen so often. So then they made those whole tankas that were so big, they would unroll them once a year, and some of them would go tied down, like in Drebon, it went down, it goes down an entire mountain. It must be like 150 yards long and 48 yards wide. It's incredible. And they started that at that time to reflect those mass visions, I think. And there's no record of them before that time.
Mm-hmm. But 94, there was something like that in a mountain, 94, when I was in Tibet. They had a mountain with that.
You saw them?
Yeah, I saw them.
Yeah, they still have a few of them around. It's marvelous. Any other question?
I think Jesus got
He founded the Tantric Datsang. There was no Tantric Datsang in the monastery.
Yeah, but that's
all. Like you do
Jume.
So the idea that some younger people could go straight to Tantra and created that curriculum also, which was an innovation from that time.
Can I say something, Bob?
What?
Can I say something?
Sure, please.
Okay. Do you want to say anything?
Chita Sukha Samsa. My job is done.
It is a very happy day, but come on, that's your turn.
Okay, I'm going to say something.
Okay.
Get ready. Okay, so one of the things that I wanted to talk about in terms of, you know, the place where I spend a lot of time and know a little bit about is those aspects of the self that keep you from being able to move into that selfless place. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've noticed, I'm just going to make a couple of general statements and then see what you think about them, okay? One of the things that I've noticed is that let me just explain. In shamanism, there's this concept of power loss as a root cause for imbalance. And this is called power loss. Power loss. And in shamanism, it's described as a kind of energy drain that's happening in the individual who's suffering a particular symptom. And there are particular symptoms that are related to power loss that are corrected with power retrieval. But I'm not going to go too far into that because I want to go over to the Siddha side of it, which is from a Buddhist point of view, that state of power loss, which is described again as an energy drain or energy kind of leaking out of the person. That state of power loss within the Siddha concepts would or could be described as a disconnection from one's own Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. And that disconnection occurs through our reactivity to being vulnerable, usually. That's that first mm-hmm. thing that you were talking about, that reaction to being harmed or something like that, and then that being the thing that consolidates the self and makes it hard for the self to be able to move into the next stages of the meditation that you were describing, right? So in shamanism, this is called being in a state of power loss. And in Buddhism, this would be called being, one could say, it's a function of the disconnection from one's Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. Do you agree? This
yeah,
makes sense
sure,
to you so
sure.
far? So then all of the strategies that we go into to try to accommodate that sense of power loss are the stuff of karmic patterns, because we're trying to avoid that pain again, or we're trying to be attached to something that we think is going to avoid, that is going to keep us from going into that vulnerability again. Or we develop misconceptions about, oh, this is what I have to do in order not to go into that vulnerability again. And so you have people who have these different strategies for accommodating their power loss that keep them on the surface of experience with other people, where you have energetic exchanges, where you have people fighting over the available life energy, which is low when you have a lot of people who are in a state of power loss, and almost everyone is in a state of power loss. And then what happens is that you have all of these karmic connections and interactions that get established with energy exchanges that are unsatisfactory for everyone, which then augments the what now in psychology would be called ego structures that are designed to try to keep the person out of power loss. And that, I think this is a pretty good description of one aspect of the psychological environment that we're dealing with when we're trying to help restore health. And one of the big problems that we have in Western medicine, for instance, is there is no concept of energy. There is no concept of this subtle experience, what, you know, in some systems are called qi or prana, lung. And so they don't have any kind of remedy for it. They don't have any way to address it. And what we try to do in depth hypnosis, which is the model that, counseling model that I developed, which combines shamanic and Buddhist understandings about the nature of suffering, mm-hmm. is we try to use the therapeutic environment as a way to first gather power that is universal power, that leads the person back into connection essentially with their Buddha nature. And so you start, the second session that you have in depth hypnosis is that power retrieval after we do the emotional biography. Now, what happens, and those of you that are in the Shamans and Siddhas class, you saw this happen in class, where there was, when we were doing the shamanic journey and making the connection with the universal source of power in the form of a helping spirit, there were some people that had difficulty connecting with that source of power because their karmic patterns that they normally run were brought forward as they were trying their usual strategies to gain power, and they weren't working, so they could not connect with universal power. When those configurations make themselves evident, and they do through the we set up processes to make sure they do happen, in depth hypnosis, when you get those configurations coming up, then you can work on helping the person dismantle their attachments, their aversions, and their misconceptions, so that they can access their Buddha nature, so that they can come out of that sense of power loss, so they can be integrated enough to even participate in this kind of meditation that you described. Because if you have not healed the self to a certain level, you cannot do this kind of meditation without going crazy. You have to have a certain level of integration, and you have to have a process that disrupts the usual non-successful, but ever that holds hope everlasting for the people that are doing it, that they are going to be successful in trying to gain power. So you have to break up those conceptualizations, those attachments, those aversions, and the patterns that they create, and connect the person with their Buddha nature so that they can rest in it, so they can let go of their selfishness, so they can let go of their ego constructs, and so that they can allow themselves to even look around and see what's beyond the self-consolidation that their pain and suffering is creating for them. So I think, you know, this meditation that you provided is, I mean, I am so grateful for that. That was like, I feel like I really understood something about the, as they say in French, the au-delà, that I hadn't understood before. It was so helpful. But I think that I just wanted to bring this idea of the importance of also working at the level that we work at in depth hypnosis, which is a much more basic level, actually.
Sure.
To help people get into a place where they can actually do that meditation. And again, the nice thing about depth hypnosis is that it is the combination of the catalytic processes of shamanic practice and working with the map, the wonderful map that Buddhism provides as a source of suffering. So I just wanted to kind of put that out there and see what kind of comments you might have or thoughts you might have about that.
Either one of you.
Well, no, I think that's, of course, you're quite right. I thought to share that other thing because I feel, you see, in Tibet, you first, in the Lamrim sort of thing, you first have developed detachment and renunciation, where you withdraw from various greed-driven things. Then you have to develop compassion, where you withdraw from various hatred-driven things. And then you, by that time, and then, of course, there has to be an ethical set of ethical changes, where you calm your life pattern down by being less turbulent with others, which you will become when you are less greedy and less angry. And so that, of course, goes without saying, that you can't really succeed in the more difficult selflessness thing until that is the case. On the other hand, and so if you go to a Tibetan teacher or a Buddhist teacher, they will not immediately teach selflessness. And even in Buddhist history, like the farmer, the donor of the monastery, etc., he would not be taught selflessness. Because that would be considered confusing and like, who am I and why? They wouldn't get into that at all. And there's an idea that emptiness, even taught to the wrong person, could lead them into a problem. But in our modern period, there is one difference about that. One reason I don't shrink from sharing these things. And even though, as I said, it was a rehearsal, you know, it takes a long time to really do it, those four keys. But because I think it's really important, it's something that Tibetan Buddhist teaching brought in, which had never been available through Zen or through any Theravada traditions or Pure Land, which is the idea that the no-self thing in Buddhism is not rejecting the relative self. Psychiatrists, for example, and psychologists and Western people were very scared of both Hinduism and Buddhism because of all this talk that you heard in the 60s and 50s and 70s about throw away your ego. You know, no, let's not have an ego. Oh, yeah, the main thing is egolessness. Let's not, no self, yeah. They thought, oh my, we're going to have a bunch of basket cases because of that. But the point is, the Tibetans were much more careful about it, you know. What you're doing is freeing yourself from the delusion of the absoluteness of your ego. You need a strong ego to do that, and you cultivate that strong ego through cultivating compassion, through cultivating self-restraint, certainly, if we were doing a longer pattern, you know. Okay? But, and then, as far as emptiness goes, the danger of sharing emptiness with the unsuitable vessel had to do with the fact that the unsuitable vessel was considered to be the person simplistically who just had faith in something. And they were fitting into their niche in society and doing their job. And they were, you know, they were spiritualistic in a religious way. And if they introduced to this kind of emptiness, they might doubt that and lose that, you follow. But modern people are a bunch of materialist nihilists already. They've already been bitten by the serpent of nihilism, which makes them formally psychotic, actually, and members of a formally psychotic culture that is not connected to the planet it's on, and that's why it's destroying the planet, and thinks that everything will be solved just by dying, And it has, it's become so bad that we are destroying the planet. There's no doubt of it. And so in a way, the emptiness becomes an antidote to the nihilism, rather than a danger of leading to the nihilism, if you will. Of course, there are those nihilists, they call themselves secular Buddhists, and they go around saying, yeah, Buddhism is just like science, and we all don't exist. That's what Buddha said. And of course, they're misleading people, and they're confused themselves. And there always will be misunderstanding of everything. You know? But that emptiness equals relativity, and that relativity equals that everything you do will have infinite consequence, and particularly the beginning, 100% beginning of the Buddhist path. And I would say in most well-developed, most other than the most backward or the most primitive tribal societies, let's call it indigenous or oral societies, the idea that the human being's spirit has continuity after death and probably before birth is a common sense thing of all humanity forever. And this unique idea that we can just get out of here by shooting ourselves or shooting somebody else is unique, you know, to a modern period. And they're shouting and screaming how religions have caused trouble. And they always seem to forget about Hitler, Lenin, Stalin, and Mao, who were not religious. But they were nihilists of different kinds, you know. So relativity is something that, you know, when you say connect, again, when you say connect to Buddha nature, then how does one define Buddha nature? Actually, the highest definition of Buddha nature is freedom, emptiness itself. And it means that each being has the nature to find their inner Buddhahood. It isn't like you have a little Buddha, a homunculus, inside the soul or something, you know. It's that because of emptiness, which means freedom, everyone is a work of art. Everyone is a work of evolutionary construction. And if they become conscious of that, they can design their evolution to lead to Buddhahood as the culmination of evolution, right? And the highest form of possible being. And actually, that's another book I'm going to write, Kela. And you like it, I'm going to borrow from you, and I'll give attribution of the Citta
Sukha Samsara.
Sukha Samsara. Because the title of that book is going to be Buddhas Have More Fun. So I do like that. That's good. But of course, the psychology thing in the Western psychology, of course, is dealing with people who are crippled by this backward culture that we have. You know, the nuclear family due to industrialization, you know, the over focus on the parents rather than the bunch of aunts and uncles and cousins, etc., in the older, more healthy societies. And the basic idea of this sort of that there's no point and purpose to it all, and it's just all go out and make some money and whatever, you know. And people are damaged by that, and therefore there's a lot of subnormal people. And so psychology is sort of focused on them, but unfortunately it focuses on them because, and the idea of healing is to bring them into being effective aggressors in an aggressive society. And that's not really helping them so much, you know. So the mixture thing is kind of complicated in the sense that the thing about power retrieval is good, but the key there, I would say, in both traditions, at least both Buddhist psychological traditions and shamanic traditions, I don't know about the Western one, will be different. So it's good to have a mediating connection with the West. I'm not against it. I'm just saying that the key to the shamanic one is also the exceptional person, not everybody in the society. And the way that they really retrieve power is by giving up all power. And the way the Buddhists do, the emptiness thing is by completely letting go and of everything. And then realizing that the universe is the power. And and you get buoyed up. You know, it's like the dark night of the soul. Those few Christian yogis who were allowed to survive in the monasteries, like John of the Cross, you know, dark night of the soul, and then you completely give up, and then you're buoyed by the loving power of the divine, you know, and which was, that's a brilliant Buddha nature retrieval, even though they have a different Christian language for it. So there, it's a tricky thing that some people in this culture, in other words, could appropriate this power retrieval thing as again another unsuccessful self-defense thing because of the language of power. And because if you go down to the depth in the shamanic thing, which again was the virtuoso in those societies who was the shaman, they were called, they had those calling experiences where they would go crazy, actually. So actually they would have to go crazy to then find out that even going crazy, reality will bring them back to life, you know? And then animals will come and bring them, and the trees and the plants, and then they're there to heal the society. So one has to be careful, I think, about with that, that's all.
I totally agree, yeah. And you wouldn't do those kinds of processes without the proper container and set and setting, right?
I think so.
I think we have to go, actually. It's 6 o'clock. Do you want to take a question, Bob? You want to take one more question?
Sure, anybody has one.
I just have a short word about your speech.
What's that?
I want to say something.
Oh, okay. Great.
My job is not done. So I think you talked about power, and the professor talked about wisdom. So in Tibetan Buddhism, we have three main Buddhas. The Buddha of wisdom, Manjushri,
yes.
And Buddha of power, Vajrapani. And then there's another Buddha, is Buddha of compassion, and Chenrezig.
That's right.
So I think, I often think why they are called the three main Buddhas. So this is the three opportunity for different type of people. Some people are very smart, very sharp and very intelligent and university analyzing like professor. And those people, I think they're very good for, you know, going through this Jetsongkhapa's path. And then another group, they are maybe not that smart or they're not ready for this path, but they are more talking about power. So that's like Vajrapani group. You know, Vajrapani is like the power Buddha. And so I think that makes sense, you know. First, you don't have power, so you try to get the power or regain the power. And then, of course, later the power joined with wisdom. Then the third group is a group of love and compassion. So they meditate on love and compassion from ordinary love to unconditional love or universal compassion. And then to bodhicitta. And then once you have that bodhicitta, you have a power too. Then you join with wisdom. So I think that's why, like Tibetan medicine says, the best medicine is the correct medicine. So that's why we cannot say everyone have to be a very smart or scholar, or also we cannot say everyone have to be a shaman to get the power. So there are many different group of people, and the best is they find their own way. But at end, I think they are all joined together. Yeah. So three groups: the love group, power group, and wisdom group. And now we have there are three represented. I just love and compassion.
Excellent. So now we're going to go have a candlelight puja. Thank you.
This podcast was made possible through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership and listeners like you. If you're inspired by what you hear in these weekly podcasts, be sure to like and share on your favorite social media platform. And when in New York City, be sure to visit Tibet House US. And when in upstate New York, visit its retreat center, Menla Mountain, located in Phoenicia, New York. Podcast music provided weekly by Tenzin Chogyal. All rights reserved.